Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Good Advice Podcast. You're tuning in to the best place to learn how to grow and scale your business. And we're talking about one of my favorite things to talk about. Have you ever wondered what it looks like to be a great boss? More importantly, is there a difference between a great manager and a great leader? Do the two terms go hand in hand, or are they something different entirely? We're going to be talking to one of my favorite leaders today, Chuck Hyde, who's the leader and owner of C3 Advisors. I can already tell you that he's going to be an amazing guest for today's show, not just because I've read a blog from him or I've read his new book, Seasons in Leadership, but because I've actually worked for the guy. That's right, he was my boss, and I've witnessed firsthand how incredible of a leader he is. I'm excited for this conversation today. You're going to learn a lot about what it means to be an effective leader. But before we dive in, let's get a word from one of the amazing businesses that sponsor the podcast. Of course, if you ever thought about advertising on the show, you can always reach out, blake@goodadvicecoaching.com. And if you have your own podcast and you're looking for us to take your podcast to the next level, you can check out our new business, Podcastable, creating content people love. Go to getpodcastable.com to find out more. Let's get a quick ad. Heck, you just got one. Let's get one more, and we'll be right back with you soon. See ya. There's one single piece of advice that I give to business owners who are ready to scale their business drastically, and that's knowing exactly what you need to hand off so that you can continue focusing on what you're an expert in. It amazes me when I talk to business owners who are doing their own bookkeeping and tax prep, and worse, that they're going through all this paperwork at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, even midnight, slaving away trying to make sense of all of the numbers for their business. Business owners who are making it happen have already figured out that you can't do it all yourself. That's why I recommend Steve Lay with Equity Business Solutions. Not only is he an expert in bookkeeping and tax prep, but what I love about Steve is that he'll sit down with you and help you make sense of the value of your business beyond just reading a spreadsheet. You'll be able to make better decisions, and more importantly, you're going to save yourself the crucial time you would have spent going through QuickBooks or an Excel spreadsheet or whatever it is that keeps us up late at night. So save yourself some time and some money by giving Steve Lay a call at Equity Business Solutions, and he'll show you the value beyond your numbers. Go to equitybusinesssolutionsllc.com to find out more. Chuck, it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks, Blake. Appreciate the invitation.
It's one of those things where I almost feel bad because I'm like, I've known you for so long and you've been such a impactful person on my professional development that makes my mind just kind of spin out to all these, like, it's funny how like people know you in a certain way.
Sure.
It's like family versus like a stranger. Like the stranger meets you and thinks you're a cool guy, but like your family really knows you.
Yeah, right.
And I almost feel that way a little bit with you, in that I have people who are like, oh, I love the podcast, it's fun. But I'm like, well, Chuck has seen fledgling Blake, and you know, you've been a really great mentor in that development. So I'm shocked that it's taken this long for me to ask you to come on the podcast.
No, I appreciate it. Actually, the complex has now been lifted. I'm like, why is Blake not inviting me to be on the podcast? It's good, man. I appreciate, years ago when we first started working together, and I remember, you know, your point of view on leadership and the things you were passionate about and what you were bringing to our team at that time. And then, you know, when you launched out on your own, I was, you know, anxious to see how it's grown. I think it's cool. Momentum you have around the podcast and your other work. We've been able to partner on some projects with clients, and that's been fun.
I'm really grateful.
Well.
Yeah. I'm really grateful that our relationship hasn't ended despite both of us having so many transitions. Right.
Yeah.
And for our listeners, so I mentioned in the intro, Chuck runs C3 Advisors. He's the author of the amazing book Seasons in Leadership. But separate from that, Chuck was my boss when I first got into the consulting world, the coaching world, back when it was, now it's Milestone Leadership, back when it was Soderquist Leadership. This was coming out of when I was a high school teacher. I moved up here. I was working on a graduate degree. I was like, what the heck am I going to do? Really liked leadership and found out there's a job where you can actually help other people with leadership. I was like, that's pretty cool. But so Chuck was my boss. And then after
After you moved on, Chuck continued, you continued to mentor me, a little bit as well. So, we actually have a little bit of a history, and so it's fun. It's fun. It's fun getting you on, man. It's fun talking business with you. For our listeners, give a little bit of like, this is always such a silly question, because it's like, give me the history. And you're like, well, I've had a whole career, right?
Yeah.
But give me the scoop on, you know, your professional career and like what's kind of brought you to where you are today.
Yeah. You know, it's, gosh, that could be a long conversation, but maybe in a nutshell, went to school for an engineering degree, you know, I mean, not for any great reason other than I liked math and science. And so, you know, went into consumer products after that, worked for a company called Kimberly Clark, maker of Huggies and Kleenex and Kotex and Depend and all these brands, and in consumer products. So I was there 12 years, eight of those in manufacturing and four of those, in supporting manufacturing plants. And really it was in that time of really the disposable diaper business of being thrown into some pretty deep water pretty early in my career. I didn't understand why I was given these opportunities, but you know, just always having to what I felt like playing up. You know, I was sometimes the younger or the youngest person in the room with the least amount of experience, trying not to be the one to mess things up.
Right.
And so, but that afforded me within a Fortune 100 environment, some pretty cool stuff. I tell people I got my MBA later, but my real MBA was the 4 years supporting the diaper business up in Wisconsin. And, you know, just really being in the center of project management on disposable diapers. Went on to, you know, again, a consulting career with Soderquist Leadership, 12 years there, eight of those as CEO. And so, opportunity then again, privileged access to people and to relationships, probably because of our founder, Don Soderquist, and probably because of just people that we kept meeting and, introduced. And so, met a lot of cool people through that, you know, and as you recall, in from your work there, the amount of insight we got and the learning we got from our clients, right? That was just kind of this compounding thing. We were always going to school in a way, and every project was a case study. And we just kept accumulating experience in some ways through our clients' experience. And so when you'd run into something again, like, oh, that's kind of like the last project, or similar in, you know, this different industry, but similar type of issue. And so we just kept learning. When it came time to exit at Soderquist, you know, we were in a transition from the organization. And I think it was time we had a leader identified as a successor. And, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do next, but decided it was time to exit there and leave well. And, went into, you know, start my next practice, and which is C3 Advisors. First 4 years of that, chairing CEO advisory boards. Just, you know, getting a bunch of small company, small to medium-sized private business in the room together that don't have a board of advisors. They became their each other's board of advisors. And they, you know, did a lot of things, a lot of work together, and a lot of successes. They lived through COVID together. You know, how did they manage through that? We did a lot of things in those 4 years that I did that. And then the last three, really just working on, as I, you know, turned that Vistage practice over and doing consulting, coaching now with the same types of organizations. Mm-hmm. I want to stay small by design. I don't do a lot of large entities, but pretty much small to medium sized private business and nonprofit work.
I love your comment on how much you learn, we learned at Soderquist. It's kind of staggering when you go back and you think about the opportunity I had to get paid to work with these businesses and really get a firsthand experience in how businesses operate, for better or worse. I mean, there was really, I remember the early days of Soderquist, I really was waiting to be found out that I didn't, you know, it was imposter syndrome. It totally, was just like, it was like, pinch me. Like, this is so fun.
But I think the thing is too, if you remember our team, you know, I used to tell people, we all did something before we landed at Soderquist. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned your career in education. that's actual real experience. Like, you understood what it meant. You saw leadership done well. You saw it done poorly.
Right.
You saw the implications of that through the organization. You understood the financial pressures of a public school system and what it either afforded or what it limited.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw all that. Well, I had it from Kimberly Clark. We had other people from Walmart, other people from higher education. We had, you know, people from ministries. I mean, there were just all kinds. And so, to me, that collection, we had that experience was somewhat different than some, maybe the career consultant, but that was the starting point, which kind of gave us some credibility. But then what we could go in and learn from and with our clients was really, again, I would say very privileged access. The other thing I would say, you know, that in our model that you probably recall is Don, our founder, used to say, we don't do remediation. I would say we don't do train wrecks.
Yeah. I've taken that. I work with new customers, I don't say I don't do train wrecks, but I basically say, like, hey, I'm not your life raft.
Yeah. Okay.
But it came from those. Again, it's just funny how this mentorship has precipitated in my own business. But whenever, because for me, I work a lot more with smaller businesses who in many cases are like grasping for a way to improve their business.
Sure.
And so I always try to make clear from the get go, hey, you know, we're going to do some great stuff together, but there's nothing, I'm not smart enough to make your business like an overnight, you know, critical success. So.
Well, in my case, because I'm probably doing maybe a bit more mature in its life cycle type business, a little bit more scale to it.
Yeah.
So they have enough scale and enough assets to be a train wreck, you know? I mean, and so, but when you come up on it, like, there are people that I know who enjoy that kind of a project and that kind of client. And do good work there. It's just not me. And it wasn't us. And so it sounds cliche, but it was a good to great type of mentality. So you run around with people that are doing really, really good work. They're leaders in their particular market or their industry. Nobody outside their market or industry knows who they are, but that's okay because they're great in that space and they just have an appetite for getting better or whatever they want to do. And so that is also, that predisposes my work today. Mm-hmm. You know, I've learned not to kind of work on turnarounds. I know people who do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I like how you put it. It's just, you know, there's people who love that. It's just, it's not either one of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, something else I was thinking about too, did you ever think of yourself as an entrepreneur? Like, when you started C3 Advisors, like, did you ever think, like, I'm stepping into the world of entrepreneurship? And
No, a resounding no. And it, you know, it's unnerving in a way. Because, you know, we were joking earlier about when are we going to get found out that, like, we don't know what we're doing, right? You know, I've kind of gotten past that, I think, because I do appreciate what I've been exposed to and trying to steward those experiences. But in terms of, gosh, is anybody going to hire me? You know, or is it, you know, that kind of thing. But I've learned to appreciate. And we have mutual friends who talk about, you know, betting on themselves and, like, okay, you know, if we go out and do good work with the right motive and we add value, there's plenty of good work, particularly in our market, to go do. The quote unquote safety of the Fortune 100, it feels good because you're on a big ship, but that, you know, can be, you know, there's a lot more, an argument can be made that's less, that's more risky than doing your own thing. And sort of making your own decisions. And so, no, I never thought I would. I will say that I've enjoyed it immensely, but just the flexibility and the freedom to choose your work and choose your clients is a real privilege. And I don't take that lightly.
How has your business evolved? Because I know one thing that's typically true in, like, the journey of solopreneurship is, you know, you start a business with, in your mind, and for me, it's funny because I think back and I'm like, I don't know what I was doing, but I know at the time it was crystal clear. And I know I thought it was crystal clear because I remember my wife asking me, hey, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, it's, you know, it's X, Y, and Z. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
But my business has very much evolved. It's not evolved in the sense of, like, now I'm a plumber now, you know, or I'm like doing something totally different. But how I internally think about it, the way I approach even my customers, I'm curious for you, have you seen your business maybe mature is a different word instead of evolve? I'm not sure. But what comes to mind?
Well, I don't know exactly what label I'd put on it. I will say when it first started out of the executive peer groups, the peer groups were tooled for processing and decision-making and thinking through with each other. But usually there was some outcome, right, that the leader needed to go do. Well, the group wasn't necessarily tooled to go like, hey, we don't know how to hire people very well. We got to fix our hiring problem. Well, the group wasn't tooled for that. I'm tooled for that. Like, I know how to set up processes. I've been trained in those kinds of things. I've got lots of experience in that kind of thing. And so what happened was those groups were pulling out of me, hey, the sort of the how-tos, like, and it was much more an operational and, which goes back to my engineering, sort of my operations mm-hmm. mindset. I'm an operator at heart. And so, I was being asked initially to teach mm-hmm. and to help construct and implement. So part of that was, my approach was more to, hey, here's some things, how does this, you know, here's something that works, or here's something that we know is true. How does that, you know, fit into your space? And like, let's do something that, you know, that you want to own. Again, part of it is they got to do it, not me. Right? As soon as it's my idea, yeah. as soon as I'm gone, right, it falls yeah. apart. So it's right. got to be theirs. But really being come alongside them. And that was the earliest part of that. And very much project-based. The thing that's happened in the last year and a half for me is doing more fractional work where I'm on retainer. And so moving away from project-based to yeah. retainer. So it's still like, okay, here's the thing we need to learn or to do or to figure out. It's going to take some time. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a duration. And so I've moved into more of a fractional role, typically fractional talent management mm-hmm. Or yeah. operations or uh-huh. strategy type of role, as a member, a de facto member of the executive team.
Yeah.
And much like a fractional CFO or a fractional CMO, right. or something like that. So
right.
that's how it's changed, which I really do enjoy because it gives me some duration and it gives me some, it's less transactional, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So there's still some deliverable, very much more. And it's much more like when I show up, I mean, I've been given my own building codes, my own login yeah. credentials, my own, you know, all the stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes some swag, you know along yeah. the way. But yeah. But I'm still a contract
yeah.
team member effectively, yeah. right? And when that work is delivered, they're gonna ask me to go away and I should.
Yeah.
And so that's been probably the biggest thing in my practice that's changed. And then I would say then content too. I mean, I'm a consumer of podcasts. You know, I've toyed with the idea myself. I'm not gonna do it anytime soon. Whether it's blogs or now with the book, just mm-hmm. what ideas have merit and how do I get some mm-hmm. of those ideas out there? Never thought I'd write a book. Never thought, you know, there's a lot of things I would never do that now I've done.
Yeah. Right.
But I would say those are the two biggest things, content mm-hmm. and then the fractional piece.
You know, and the fractional role is so much of a norm nowadays. And I actually, probably 5 years ago, I don't know if this is like come out of the gig economy of, you know, businesses are getting so much more used to outsourcing and hiring out. And you've seen that grow from, you know, an hourly role to this, what I would think would probably be like the peak of that would be right. a fractional role. But nowadays it seems like it's a fairly common, I don't say a fairly common hire, but you don't have to look far to find a business who sees the value in something like that.
Right, particularly in that scaling life cycle, you see it because they're not big enough to go acquire the talent full time,
right?
At the market rate, if you will. But they go outsource it for a while. They only need a fraction of that now. The hourly rate, if you were to make that a sort of annualized equivalent, it'd be way more expensive than a person.
Right.
But your actual spend is a lot less. And so financially, it makes a lot of sense. You get the thing you need in the dose that you get it. One of my mentors with our peer groups was, you know, he talked about timing and dosage. The fractional model is really about timing and dosage, right? At this time, here's the dose I need now. And there have been times when most of the time when I conclude one of those engagements, it's because we've delivered the work. But another time is the company had grown to a point and they needed a full-time me. And it wasn't me, right? But they needed to find, and they hired a full-time CHRO And I was like, okay, great. You don't need me anymore, right? Because now you've got that full-time person that you need. Mm-hmm. They knew I was going to be an asset to them should mm-hmm. they ever need it. But that was the thing mm-hmm. that they had progressed to the point where they needed to acquire that full-time expertise, mm-hmm. and they did. So
I know one thing you're really big on are assessment tools
yeah.
that assist you in talent acquisition. And man, this conversation can go so many different ways because talking about hiring talent, you know, one of the things I've talked about, I'm sorry for our listeners not to call it to attention to it. I guess my nose is running.
Spring allergies.
Yeah,
man.
I guess so. Season, so. You know, part of me wants to ask you about pay and is sort of like this tedious continuing conversation on like, what's the right wage and, you know, what do I pay people and what does that look like? But then the other side of the conversation are the tools you use to hire really well.
Yeah.
I know one, I think you still like it. Predictive index.
Big fan.
Okay. I didn't want to bring it up and be like, we broke up. We're done.
No, we still like each other a lot.
So for the listeners, what is PI predictive index?
Well, a predictive index is a behavioral assessment. It's in the same family as a Berkman, a Myers-Briggs, DISC, other good tools with good science behind them. It all generates from originates from the same body of work from the 50s and, you know, in psychometrics and things like that. The one thing about PI that it does, that maybe the others don't do that I really appreciate is, to your point, the hiring component. If you're familiar with the term, you know, the Jim Collins idea, let's get the right people on their bus, right? And then mm-hmm. let's get the right people in the right seat. And so in most routine assessments in hiring that's not a PI application, you can get an assessment of the person, and that's one data point. Among mm-hmm. the data points, you get to make a hiring decision. Hey, mm-hmm. how's this person? Mm-hmm. How's this person wired? How they tick on a certain day or on any given day, right? What PI does that the others don't that I think is brilliant is that they actually profile the seat. So yeah. not just the person, but the seat. And now I can overlay, does a person's profile naturally fit what the job is going to naturally demand?
Right.
Right. And so in some ways I never thought about it, but it's really supply and demand. And so it doesn't mean that someone can't stretch or can't work out a preference in a job, but you can predict, is that natural? Is it how much energy are they going to have to expend in that job? And so you actually get greater
retention
right? and yeah. fulfillment and performance and because it yeah. actually allows people to do what they naturally do well.
Right.
And I mean, I've seen it, you know, in terms of the hire. But I've also seen even internal promotion. One of my favorite stories is we had a subscriber who had a vacancy at a director level, and one of the team members had filled in, mm-hmm. you know, as a, you know, while during the search, this team member's, you know, great team member, happy to jump in and do whatever. And they began to think, well, hey, we'll call her Sally. Maybe we should just promote Sally into that job. I mean, gosh, she's over there doing a great job. And I knew Sally. I knew the role. Mm. And they asked me, what do you think about Sally in the job? And I was like, well, I don't know. I think Sally's great. But have you looked at the fit? And you might want to, because there's some things in my head about it. You know, and so anyway, when they looked at it, long story short, Sally withdrew her consideration because she, through the data, it prompted a conversation. The data starts good conversation. Mm-hmm. That's really what it does. Through the good conversation, they realized, both Sally and the team, this is going to force her to do some things that she's not naturally good at. Mm-hmm. She does not enjoy. It's going to be a major stressor for her. It's going to take her away from the right seat she's in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and she's like, no, I want to stay where I'm at. I love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
The discipline and the maturity it took for somebody to decline a promotion,
mm-hmm.
right? Just through the data causing the conversation to happen. So all that being said, yeah, I'm a big believer in it's again, you know, I think we all mm-hmm. do use these. It's again, a data point among many,
mm-hmm.
but that particular one around hiring, I mean, a big part of my work on hiring is, I mean, I ask the question routinely, why do intelligent, experienced, high capacity professionals routinely make bad hiring decisions? And there's reasons for it, right? Mm-hmm. And when we peel that onion back, you're like, oh my gosh. So let's stop doing that stuff and let's start doing some things that make sense. And that's,
yeah,
that's part of my work there.
I almost think like, you know, we love the saying the right people on the bus, but I think we miss the nuance of the right people on the bus and in the right seat.
And in the right seat.
And
absolutely.
I think few businesses really empower their people enough to create like a two-way communication where the person can say, because a lot of times I remember back when we worked at Soderquist and Lazy Boy was one of our customers. Yeah. I remember, and we were doing some kind of leadership program. I can't remember the details, but this person had gotten picked to move up and the guy was like, I love it on the floor. Like, yeah. I don't, nothing against you guys. I just don't want this.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this. And Lazy Boy always did a great job with their people, but you know, I just always respect an organization that creates the space for that conversation to happen.
Well, one of my first executive coaching assignments was a COO who had thought he wanted the CEO job some years back, didn't get it. The CEO came and, you know, then retired and exited. And so now it's open again. He's like, I think that's all. I said, well, hey, let's take a look at that. We literally on a whiteboard sketched out. I said, what's that job? What's your job today require of you? Like 1 through 12, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's that? What's the CEO job require? 1 through 12. And we started looking at it, like, how many of these things on this side of the board do you like? I mean, like 12 out of 12, right? I love them. I'm great at it. And I'm like, okay, how many of these things do you really like? Well, like two? And eight of them are life-taking, you know, for me. I'm like, okay, well, why do you want that job?
Yeah, right.
I mean, and so, but our momentum, our culture, our society, like all kinds of things just continue to promote high performers in a given area to some role outside of their skill set, outside of their natural gifting, outside of their passion. And we do it over and over.
That's the Peter principle. The cliche for our listeners. I mean, it's the person who's great at sales who
becomes a salesman, like, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. And they don't know the first thing about managing people.
Yeah.
Right.
See it all the time.
Yeah.
Well, education,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, so you see it all the time.
Now you've also, I remember even with Soderquist, but you know, you're in this conversation of management, of hiring well. I feel like I have to ask you about, hiring across generations.
Yeah.
We had a large team at Soderquist. We had a lot of different people at different phases of their career.
Yeah.
But all the way down to sort of like, we called them fellows, but they're sort of like, what we would understand for our listeners to sort of be like, corporate interns almost.
Yeah. I mean, project managers, it's really in their first, in their first
interns,
real
a little bit too
professional role, but you know, they were entry level.
Yeah. All that to say, all the way up to people who had, you know, executive in residence in the organization.
Yeah.
I'm really kind of laughing at like these LinkedIn posts where people are like, sorry, Gen Zers, but, and then they like say like something like smug. And I'm like, this is kind of nice that I'm not getting dunked on as the millennial. Like, you know, I'm just, cause I remember reading those posts as the millennial.
Yeah.
And I even remember I had a customer once who we were working on his team and he was like, well, you know, millennials are just impossible to manage.
Right.
And I was like, all right, well, I'm a millennial, but okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've worked with a lot of different people from all different walks of life. Like what's your, I don't say like, what's your take? I mean, I kind of know your take, but like, how do you approach those kinds of conversations?
I was at a ball game one time with my dad. My dad is in the greatest generation, right? That's where he's from. And so we were at a ball game one time and a few rows below us. And this is years ago, right? But, you know, smartphones were just kind of a thing, right? And there was a dad and another dad and a young man, probably in his teens, on his phone. And my dad looks down there and, arr, you know, yeah. Look at that kid on this phone. He's not even
never
watching the game.
In the moment.
Arr, yeah, you know, yeah, and yeah. I'm like, ah, well, you know, and so, yeah, I get it. But what we began to think about was, and when I think about that is, it's not that we don't value the same thing, is that the value gets expressed differently. For my dad, who, you know, moved around some of his career, but like community to him was the Kiwanis Club and the, you know, and his church board, and, you know, getting involved in things, you know, and really roots from that generation. That's what community meant. That's how community was expressed. Well, in the early stages of the smartphone, and certainly today, community gets expressed a lot of different ways, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's your followers on social media. It's your friend that you met, you know, that you grew up with, and now they live halfway around the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, when my son, my older son, Charlie, when he was in fourth grade, two of his best friends moved to Africa. Right. I mean, you know, well, so now community is done differently. We had we had fellows in our staff that grew up from different places from all over the world, and they had relationships all over the world. So I think about it like, okay, let's not we get caught up in how the value gets expressed and call it like we don't value the same thing. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we do value the same thing if you really back it up and take a look at it. Well, I will say this for your listeners. If you haven't seen it yet, I want to say it was a 2023 book, might have been 22. Dr. Tim Elmore, A New Kind of Diversity, actually investigates this whole generational thing in a way that that's the best I've seen, and just talks about everything, like why, as a Gen Xer for me, why I need to be reverse mentored by a Gen Z, right? And so what I can learn from them, and the things that I know and bring value, and the things they know and bring value, are actually better when we have respect for each other and are curious about what the other one brings, because Elmore's premise is effectively, we are who we are because of the circumstances in which we grew up, the time and the major events and the influences, things like that. And that predisposes us to a certain way of thinking and functioning. But gosh, when we're, you know, if you think of a workforce, like in our case, what you're describing at Soderquist, I think, well, we might've been before ahead of our time. I don't think we were perfect, but we gave those young professionals real responsibility.
100%.
Right.
100%.
We gave them, we told them like, hey, there's no net, there's no redundant backup. If you drop the ball, it's dropped. Right. So we were bringing them into real responsibility, and learning from them. I remember I refused to text for years until one of our grad students convinced me of the business value of me beginning to text.
Yeah.
Right. She was mentoring me.
Yeah.
And so I think it's this, we have a lot more in common than we have in different, it's really just, if we could appreciate that about each other, there's a lot of upside to that.
I don't know if this came from you, or I don't know where I'm thinking of. And I almost, my friends who know me know I can never quote the expression correctly. It's always like some butchered version of it. But I'm thinking of like people basically rising to the occasion of like what you provide for them, like the opportunity you provide for them, they will rise up to whatever that is. And that was something that was absolutely true at Soderquist. I guess I was... maybe 26, 27 when I started there.
Just a babe, man.
And, you know, I actually remember going to a customer meeting one time, and the guy actually asked me how old I was. I was like, I'm 27. And he was like, okay.
Well, but yeah, that, yeah.
It, what I was just going to say was, I really felt, empowered and in control of my own professional journey. I knew nothing about sales, but I remember, I don't think you would remember this, but I remember asking you, hey, can I sit in on the business development meetings?
Okay.
Cause I just want to learn.
Yeah.
And I just remember like how it wasn't weird. At least I don't think it was. Maybe it was weird.
No,
it wasn't weird. And no one was like, why are you here?
Right.
And I think about other moments about my time at Soderquist where, there was another time where we like went through the P&L. And I remember thinking like, am I supposed to be here? Like, this is way above my pay grade, you know? So like, there were definitely opportunities where it was never, hey, you're not old enough to be in the room. It was like the opportunities there for anyone who's excited to take advantage of it, which I really appreciated.
Well, for me, not that I was necessarily driving this, but I would say that for me, anytime someone shows appetite for learning and growth, I'm like, come on, let's go. Right. Yeah. And I think just appetite for what you don't know. And I would say that one of the, when we got into high performance teams research and work and, you know, facilitating, that process, one of my favorite words that to this day still, 10 something years later from that introduction, was the idea of interdependence.
Mm.
Right. And the idea that, man, when there is something wrong over in a different part of the company, the pain is felt over here where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because if we understand how their work depends on ours, or our work depends on theirs, or just the connectedness of, like, we have shared interests and shared results. And so I think the interdependent nature of work is undervalued and invested in. And so, like, yeah, come on, let's look at the P&L. I mean, I told somebody this week, I said, my goal as a CEO was to be shockingly transparent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I can't believe you just said that. That was the goal for sometimes when I was, you know, like, wow, he just told us that, right?
Yeah.
That was but I wanted it to be that way. Understanding there were times when I couldn't be, right? It was either something that had to be held in confidence,
right,
or the timing wasn't just right yet. There's time for that. But I always felt like that by doing that, when I had to withhold information, our team would say, well, we don't know exactly why he's not telling us, but there must be a reason because he tells us everything else.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that served our team really well.
So one thing I've been thinking about a lot from, like, a sales perspective is how sales is so much easier when you and your potential customer are, you know, to use like a Bible Belt phrase, now I can't think of it now that I'm equally yoked.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was on a sales call the other day, and I was just, I had two sales calls that day. The first one was a total bombshell. It just wasn't good at all.
Right.
And I could just tell we had, from the moment the conversation started, we had drastically different understandings about business and what our work together would look like. Second sales call was so incredibly easy. And the person was like, you're saying all the right things to me. And I was just talking.
Yeah.
And I was reflecting afterwards, you know, as any entrepreneur would, I was reflecting, okay, what was the difference in those two conversations? And something that came to a head for me was, you know, man, sales is so easy when you're equally yoked with someone, when you have the same values, you see things the same way. My question for you is, there are so many different philosophies of leadership out there. And working with you at Soderquist was incredibly valuable. I don't want to call it unique in the sense of there are businesses that get it and operate that way, but I wouldn't call it common. I wouldn't call it a commonality that every business is going to operate that way. A lot of businesses withhold information. There are, you know, it depends on your position in the company.
Yeah.
They're siloed, they're isolated. That interdependence you're talking about, it's, well, that's the marketing team. Well, that's business development. That's nothing to do with me. You know, what have you. When you're working with someone, what's your process for figuring out, are we on the same page? And do you get into situations where you're not and you feel like there's an opportunity to kind of like reel them in? Or, like, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to remember the graphic on my website, right? Because when I started this practice, there was a, got some good advice from people to really understand how you were going to go do that. And so the process, my guaranteed process would be, first of all, let's do some mutual discovery. Right. And I want to hear about you and I want you to know about me. Right. Because, like, I'm not going in to win a transaction. Cause I may not be the fit.
Yeah.
And I guess I've been doing it long enough to know that when you're not equally yoked or when it's just not the right fit, and nobody's winning in that deal. Right. Mm-hmm. I may be delivering value and they may be paying me, but it just doesn't feel good. And right. I'm kind of old enough now. I get to some point in my career. I'm just like, I don't want to do that. And so, if I start with, tell me about you, and then where's the intersection, where's the overlap of, can I be helpful? Because I really do, like, one of the commitments I make to my clients is wealth management folks is a fiduciary role. I'm committed to doing what's best for you, even if it's not best for me. And we talked offline about just, you know, referrals. There have been times when you've come in, gosh, this week you've introduced me to somebody like, I think it'd be a really good connection for this guy. And I've brought you in on projects and I've, you know, different things like that. And so it's this freedom of there's plenty of good work to go on out there. And so I want to know enough about you to know if I'm the right fit, because it's not fair to you. And frankly, it's not fair to me. It's not how I want to practice if we don't know. So the first is just that discovery. We're going to do a mutual discovery, a mutual exploration. And I'm going to come in with a recommendation. That recommendation may or may not be with me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there have been times when I have believed that I was the right answer. Like, I got this one. Like, I got this in truckloads. We know how to do this. We're going to knock this out.
Right.
And when the prospect elects to go another way, like it kind of really, you know, I mean,
I think it's kind of like people who can't help themselves to sabotage a little bit.
It's pride, you know, I mean, honestly, it's my own pride and different things like that. But I will tell you this, and it was a time years ago at Soderquist, we were over in Tulsa, in a healthcare organization, and they were in a nearing crisis. Like, they could see around the corner and crisis was there waiting on them. And in that situation, our team had sat there and we'd like, hey, here's the way to miss that and deal with it now, before you're in that situation. And I remember at the time, in their case, they were more paralyzed to do the right thing versus arrogant. You know, they weren't like, well, I'm just going to do it this way, or I think this person's a better fit or whatever. But it was that day that I came up and it hit me in the head. And I it's just still true. The moment in a sales conversation, a consultant and prospect situation, the moment I care about you more than you care about you, we've got a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't care more about you than you care about yourself. Mm-hmm. And if that is short-sightedness or pride on your part, or you want to negotiate price in an unreasonable way, and the value of what this really means to your business or whatever, and like, I just got stuff to do.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And now, going back to the entrepreneurship, it sometimes scary to walk away from a contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've done it. Sometimes it's scary to fire a bad client.
Mm-hmm.
But I've done it.
Yeah.
I've done it at Soderquist. I've done it at C3.
Yeah.
But I've never regretted any of those situations either. What I've regretted is taking it anyway.
Yeah.
Or sticking with it longer than I should. And so it's just not worth it, man.
I think it's tough. It's something at our, we have a Tuesday morning for our listeners. We have a Tuesday morning entrepreneurship meetup. It's kind of like a mastermind, that's at Red Kite in Springdale. And one of the things we've been talking about lately is like the nuance of running a business and how like there's these hard and fast rules, but when you're actually in it, you understand like the complexity of it. A good example of this is like, you know, you never keep a bad customer. Well, the nuance of that is from like a cash flow perspective, that might be a really great customer on paper, even though they're a nightmare of a customer. But I think you're really right. Even when you can see the upside, like you really as a business owner have to weigh, you know, yes, there's upside here. I don't think it's ever as blatantly obvious as there are no, like the pros and cons list. There's no pros here. And there's always pros involved. But I do think you're right. I think there's situations where it's like, even though there's this list here, like this is everything it's costing me.
Well, I think maybe I'm remembering a conversation we had at Soderquist back in the day, and I think might be interesting to your roundtable. It's that, We as consultants and coaches and, you know, and really I get probably anybody, I guess, you can choose what business you want to do, what you want to offer. You can't choose what's in demand.
Mm.
You can try to influence demand, right? You can kind of create demand for what it is, whatever it is you do, but you can't choose demand. And so there are times when, I don't know if you've ever been involved in these debates, well, why don't we do more of this kind of work versus that kind of work? Because I think this kind of work's fun, or I think this kind of work's really meaningful, or I think this whatever. Like, well, yeah, but this kind of work is also in our sweet spot. It's in our wheelhouse. And in the mix, and you know, I'll go back to my consumer products days, like we're managing mix, right? How much of any given kind of work can we reasonably do? And I understand that this type of work isn't super meaningful to you, but that's what's in demand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good work and we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're suggesting here, there's a certain amount of demand for that, but we're not going to go out and like pay everybody's salary on that deal. So yeah. It was very, very much a P&L, you know, the number on the top needed to be more than the number on the bottom, right? Let's be clear.
Well, and I think that's a great insight too, is just because a lot of times when we get into business, we're really energized around something in our mind of like what we see ourselves doing.
Yeah.
And I think the truth of running a successful business is you have the things you love to do and you have the things people will pay you for. And ideally you find a way to blend those together.
Yep.
I mean, ideally it is the same thing.
Well,
but I think a lot of times business owners, there was in fact a business owner one time who we were talking about his business and he was like, well, and we're talking about what people were signaling they were buying. And he's like, well, that's not the kind of business I want to run. That's not what I'm looking to sell. And it was like, okay, but what you're looking to sell, no one is buying. Like that's the rub there.
Well, I would tell you, I think it's perspective too. Like what, you know, cause in appreciating everyone's perspective and their story and what drives them, I don't suppose there's a wrong answer, but I think it's the perspective of like in that particular situation, you remember at Sotico, it's like, we would love the deep personal life change,
right.
Like intimate, like,
right.
Right. That we loved that.
Right.
Right. Because right. You could see it and like people would talk about it years later, how life changing
right.
A certain event or program was. And we loved that. Right.
Yeah.
And that felt like life change. Something I'll call it maybe more, you know, dollars and cents, like a strategic plan.
Yeah.
Didn't feel the same to us. Right.
Yeah.
But I was at the time, I remember the last, one of the last strategic plans I facilitated on our team was it was a manufacturer up north in a town and like literally had one stoplight, right? But they were the largest employer in town. They were really good at what they do. They're market leader, had a few hundred employees, by far the largest employer in town. And when you go up to that particular town and you're sitting there and you're looking at those people and you begin to think about a strategic plan actually provides ongoing growth and job creation and opportunity and funding the school system and the parks, you know, the park was built by the company, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a city park, right? The playground.
Yeah.
Like there's a big sign there that says, hey, here's the company, right?
Yeah.
And like, I would argue that's also life changing.
Yeah.
For those people to have secure, gainful, productive employment that helps the quality of life and their hopes and dreams and their mortgage and all that stuff. Like that's pretty cool. So I think it's a calibration on where we get that from and can we see that?
Yeah. Well, we're way over time, which is great.
I was afraid we were. Sorry.
It's a great sign for you, right? I would never want my guest to be insecure when it's like, we ended 15 minutes early today. So
well, maybe in a few years you can bring me back. Right?
Yeah,
we'll do it again.
Hopefully soon. I do a round two. We need to, there's more I want to ask you about, more I want to talk about. This has been really fun. You've been a great guest. For people who are listening, what's next? How do they connect with you? I know you have the book, Seasons in Leadership. Can they get that off?
Yeah, so Seasons and Leadership is available on the website. My website's c3adv.com. So C, then the number 3, then ADV as in advisors.com. It's also available on Amazon. And so you can order it off either place and get it that way. What people don't know about probably is it started as a workshop. So it's actually in workshop form as well out there for different, you know, come back to our content and the way to,
yeah,
to create that. But yeah, so you can find it there. And there's way my contact information is on the website and certainly can reach me there, LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I'm not hard to find.
Yeah. Well, Chuck, it's been great having you on the podcast.
Man, I appreciate you, Blake.
Hey, for our listeners, if you're following the podcast for the first time, what the heck are you waiting on? Click the subscribe or follow button so you keep getting good advice wherever you are. And for those of you who support the podcast and have been following it long term, I so appreciate you. That's today's good advice. We'll catch you later. See ya.